You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good morning to everybody. My name is Domenico Lombardi. I'm a senior fellow here at Brookings. And I want to welcome you to this event on the on assessing the Financial Stability Board. The Financial Stability Board was established by the G20 leaders at the height of the perhaps recent or ongoing financial crisis in 2008 as a successor to the Financial Stability Forum, which had a kind of more G7-like, G7-plus structure, a more narrow structure than the FSB has. The FSB has an expanded membership, as you know, was established with a broadened mandate and a stronger institutional basis. And yet, despite its importance, relatively little is known on the on how the FSB operates and how it is governed and what it actually does in reality. And in response to this gap, the Brookings Institution convened a high-level panel that examined the governance of the Financial Stability Board and formulated a number of recommendations in order to align the Financial Stability Board governance with evolving international best practices. And it did so through this high-level panel, which comprises a very diverse group of experts, ranging from former deputy prime ministers, former finance ministers and central bank governors, to senior academics and members of the civil society. So the outcome of the work by the high-level panel is a dozen of recommendations that assess various aspects of the FSB mandate, organization, and governance. They will be available at the reception desk by the time the meeting ends, and of course they will be posted by the time the meeting ends on the Brookings website. So we'll leave you with a little bit of suspense and an incentive to listen carefully to this panel. Importantly, all the high-level panel members draws from the various regions of the world. So this is also another aspect of the composition of the panel that we want to stress. I would like to use this opportunity to thank the members of the high-level panel, Amar Bhattacharya, the head of the G24 Secretariat, Danny Bradlow, professor of international law at the American University and the University of Pretoria in South Africa, Eric Kaliner, professor at the University of Waterloo and CG chair in global governance, Luis Kasakende, deputy governor of the Central Bank of Uganda, Harold James, professor at Princeton University, Jean-Marie Gris-Greber, Jacques Mistral, head of economic studies of IFRI, a French think tank, and member of the Conseil d'analyse économique of the French Prime Minister. Besma Momani, who's sitting right there, associate professor at the University of Waterloo and senior fellow at CG, the Canadian think tank. José Antonio Campo, professor at Columbia University, former finance minister of Colombia and former UN Undersecretary General. Jean-Marthe Otorbaev, former deputy prime minister of the Kyrgyz Republic. Pedro Solbes, former EU commissioner for economic and monetary affairs and former deputy prime minister and finance minister of Spain. Ezra Suruma, who's sitting in this panel, distinguished visiting fellow here at Brookings and former finance minister and central bank governor of Uganda. And Chalongpob Susankart, distinguished fellow at the Thailand Development Research Institute and former finance minister of Thailand. I would also like to express my wholehearted appreciation to Jamie Baker, who's right there at the end of the room, NeuroRules coordinator, for her effective support to the high-level panel. So really, thanks, Jamie. Before turning to the to today's panelists, let me briefly introduce the two members of the high-level panel that are sitting here and who will provide a snapshot of the high-level deliberations, high-level panels deliberation. To my far left, I have Jean-Marie Gris-Graeber, the Executive Director of New Rules for Global Finance Coalition, a non-governmental Washington-based international network of activists and researchers concerned with the reform of the international financial architecture. And to my far right, I have Ezra Suruma. He's, as I said, the former finance minister of finance and currently serving as presidential advisor to the president of Uganda. And we have invited two outstanding discussants to offer a unique perspective, both from the private sector and from academia. To my immediate left, there is Peter Sands, the CEO of Standard Chartered Bank. Before his appointment as the bank's chief CEO, he was responsible for finance, strategy, risk and technology, and operations. Peter is also the non-lead executive director of the board of the Department of Health, and he was a director with McKinsey before joining Standard Chartered Bank. To my immediate right, Mary Woods. She's a professor of international political economy, academic director of the Blavatnik, I hope my pronunciation is correct, School of Government at Oxford University. And she's also the director of the Global Economic Governance Program at Oxford University, and also a dear friend. We hope to have joining us Svein Andresen, the Secretary General of the Financial Stability Board, who was supposed to be with us now. Given the ongoing developments, he has been called at a very short notice to attend a meeting of senior officials, and he said he would be with us later on this morning. So before turning to you, Jean-Marie, I would remind the rules of the game. So you'll have some 5-7 minutes for your remarks. Then we will be having a discussion among the panelists, and then we are going to open up for a Q&A session with the audience. So without further ado, Jean-Marie, I would leave you the floor. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Domenico. Excuse me. Thank you, Domenico. Domenico was the lead for this entire initiative, and he's also a member of the Board of New Rules, so I'm doubly grateful to him. And I think this was a really masterful exercise because we used all of modern technology, webinars, and so on. So we polluted the environment, not at all. So that's one positive contribution from the get-go. I also want to note that there will be a brand new website on the Financial Stability Board. It's called fsbwatch.org. It's being launched today, so you're the first to know. The rationale for this whole process on the Financial Stability Board is very much value-based. It's that the focus has been, at least from my perspective and in getting this whole initiative underway, is what happens to the poorest countries and to the poorest people around the world as a consequence of financial regulation or the lack of great financial regulation. And the two centers, the two foci of financial rulemaking at the global level is the IMF, which is what pretty well known, and the Financial Stability Board, which I call the quintessential black box. Almost no one knows what it is or what it's doing. And if you can read their website, I get lost in all the acronyms myself. I really do need a map. So it needs light, transparency, translation, because it's a very, very important institution. It's a growing institution. It's a new kind of institution. It's much more networking. But that being said, let me focus on a couple of principles for global governance of any international institution. One is comprehensiveness. It undertakes all the responsibilities in its mandate. Two, legitimacy. Three, transparency. And four, perhaps most importantly, accountability. By comprehensive, we you will note in the recommendations that we encourage the FSB to go beyond any specific recommendations from the G20, which really is the directorate for the FSB, and propose issues that need attention. And the two that one came up very prominently in our discussions is the issue of transborder currency flows. There needs to be some attention and some regulation to transborder currency. Right now, it's a null issue. It's simply not addressed by the IMF or by the FSB. And another one that is, what can I say, very much on the front pages of our business sections, and that is the situation of sovereign debtors. How do we deal with indebted sovereigns? This has been an issue that the developing world has dealt with since 1982, and now it's in the developed world. There's a deafening silence about it, and reasoned, systematic attention should be given to it. Secondly, on legitimacy, the G20 is certainly better than the FS Financial Stability Forum and much better than the G7. However, it makes rules, I like to say, for the cosmos, not just for the rich countries who participate, but for all the known and unknown world. So why repeatedly we hear from non-member countries, whether Colombia or Norway, why do we have to adhere to regulations when we have no voice, we're not in the room, we're not consulted? Even more so, the low-income countries who are impacted but scarcely know about the FSB and how to influence, although the Francophone low-income country yesterday stated their concern about the inclusivity and legitimacy of the FSB for exactly these reasons. We would hope that there's allusion to this in the recommendations, moving toward a more inclusive process. And for all the maligning I have done of the IMF constituencies, it is a very good model. It's not used perfectly at the fund or the bank, but it's a very good model to have a small table but include everybody. A strange element of the FSB is that it includes non-countries called the SSBs. And if you're on an international call and you're talking FSBs and SSBs, it can be extremely confusing. SSBs are standard-setting bodies, and they go everything from IOSCO and the Basel Committee all the way to the International Accounting Standards Board. Some of them are comprised wholly of governments, and the International Accounting Standards Board is wholly private, and then you have the blended institutions in between. What are they doing there? I mean, it's good to have them there. It's a novel institution, but it's very strange, especially if you are an excluded non-member entity. So that's a question, and it's a puzzlement of the New World Order where entities beyond the nation state are important. The fourth principle is that of transparency. We note that the FSB is becoming more transparent, but before the reports are concluded, we would like to know the names of the chairs of the committee, how to send information to them, what the terms of reference are for each of the working groups, and then a way for people to contribute, whether countries or academics or think tanks or, God forbid, activist NGOs. And finally, accountability. Accountability requires transparency and representation. It also requires job descriptions and the ability not only to hire beyond Europe, which is a geographic limitation right now, but how do you fire the chair of the FSB? On what grounds? There's no provisions. It's a brand new entity. So that's an essential element. We don't have that, for example, in the IMF. We know political pressure can force managing directors out, and even some executive directors, but there's no terms in which you can fire them or hold them accountable for failure to perform. And then finally, we do have evaluation, and this is a very important element of accountability, is to evaluate not only the leadership the management and staff, but also the performance of the whole institution. So it's a pretty vague recommendation, but I think it's an essential element to good governance in this contemporary time. So thank you very much, Domenico, for excellent leadership and brilliant writing.
Thank you very much, Jo Marie. Ezra?
Thank you very much. Our main address, the issue of this legitimacy tension, the fact that the FSB is a creature of the G20, and the rest of us who are not members of the G20 may be expected, or will be expected, to implement and follow the recommendations of the FSB and the standards set by the various standard-setting bodies. As Jo Marie pointed out, there has been a long-standing problem of voice for the developing countries. And in the case of Africa, for example, where I come from, we have only one country, South Africa, as a member of the G20. And I don't believe that many of us would consider that South Africa speaks for us in the FSB or in the G20. And yet, over the years, we've had to implement rules and regulations and standards set by the IMF, and we've complained that we don't have much voice in the IMF. And we've been making some progress there and in the World Bank, not enough, but some. And now comes the FSB, and there we don't have any representation at all, or hardly any representation. So the issue we've been discussing in the high-level panel is how we could also have some say in what is going on in FSB, so that we fear that the recommendations made by FSB can be applied to us, and would not be too resentful that we have not been consulted. There is a proposal. Well, some members of the panel fear that in the long run, if the FSB is to be legitimate, it should be a universal organization with universal membership. It should be a treaty-based organization. But that probably takes some time to occur. So in the meantime, there's a view that we could have regional consultative groups. And if I remember correctly, Africa was supposed to be one such group. Africa is a very large country. I mean, a continent with more than 50 countries and very diverse. And we didn't think that this kind of arrangement would work very well. So we are proposing that perhaps the way that the regional groups, consultative groups, are formed should be based on a bottom-up approach, rather than the FSB saying this is how we want the region to be composed. It should be the countries in Africa themselves to work out an arrangement for the composition of the consultative groups. And we've suggested that there are some existing regional groups and some regional groups. For example, we have COMESA in Africa with 20 countries and more than 700 billion in total GDP of these countries. So clearly it would qualify to have a chair who could represent them in FSB plenary meetings. And the current arrangement proposals are that the G20 person would be a co-chair of the of the regional meetings, I guess this could be looked at. But what is important is that the forming of the regional groups should come from the countries themselves, rather than coming from FSB. And we hope that the regional secretariats that could be formed in the regional groups would be a channel for liaison with FSB, and also an opportunity for learning, for capacity building, because a great deal of learning needs to take place, particularly in my continent. So we recognize that this would not cure the complaint or the feeling that we are not consulted, but at least if there is a channel of communication between our regions, and members are free to join the regions that seem to make a great deal of sense to them, this communication would ease the tension and give us a sense of representation and consultation. And hopefully this could be working in the meantime until such time as FSB becomes a treaty-based organization. So this is the area where I have been most concerned, and I think I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ezra. Now I would give the floor to the two external discussants. Peter, do you want to go first?
Okay. I think it's absolutely right to focus on the FSB because it is much more important than its profile in the media and political debate would suggest. And Mario Draghi, who's been chairman of the FSB, has been one of the more influential voices in the shaping of financial regulation around the world. And I am broadly sympathetic to the high-level panel's recommendations. The FSB was cobbled together in a hurry as a development of the Financial Stability Forum, and there is a need for fine-tuning and refining its governance processes and arrangements, such as how you select a new chairman. And I think that is a very sensible thing to focus on. But I think we need to be careful not to overdo it. There are many, many committees and meetings around the world in which these issues are discussed, which are highly formalized and in which people speak to prepared briefs, and where there is very little discussion, just a sort of lobbing of views over the table at each other. And one of the refreshing things about the FSB was actually that it had a degree of informality and real dialogue and disagreement. And we need to be careful as we evolve the governance model and process that we don't stultify it and make it into something that is exactly like all the other things that exist already. Where I do absolutely agree is the need to make sense of the multitude of interacting organizations whose remits and mandates overlap in ways that even as the CEO of an international bank, I can never quite work out whether something is coming from the Basel Committee or the FSB, and does it make any difference given that most of the people are the same anyway. I do wonder slightly whether some of this concern about legitimacy and accountability is perhaps a bit misplaced, because the FSB only has a voice. The Basel Committee has power. I think if you really want to focus on where the key standards are being set without the voice of much of the world, I think there's much more of an issue in the Basel Committee than there is in the FSB. But I agree that kind of casting light and sorting out the tangle of how these things interact has enormous value. I also am very sympathetic to the view that the FSB shouldn't just sort of jump to whatever comes out of the G20 communique in terms of what it should look at next, but should form its own view and feed that back into the G20. But I must admit, given a sort of title of a discussion which is around assessing the FSB, I'm afraid to say my immediate focus is not actually on governance and process. My immediate focus is on outcomes. Has the FSB achieved what it was asked to achieve, which was to ensure greater financial stability and to ensure greater international coordination and consistency in achieving that end? And I'm afraid to say it would be hard to give it a very high grade on either of those points. Now, it's not entirely the FSB's fault because other things have been going on, but the fact that Sven can't even be here is sort of slightly indicative of the fact that we haven't yet got to a state of financial stability that leaves us all totally assured. And part of the problem here is that we haven't been focusing on the right things. And I would say this to Sven, I'd say it to Mario. The FSB has spent a disproportionate amount of its intellectual ability and effort, and it has fantastic people, you know, very, very smart people involved, focused on an elaborate closing of stable doors. There has been a lot of fighting the last war rather than working out what the threats are to financial stability that we face now and what we should be doing them about them looking forward. If you look at the papers that have been published, and I just checked last night to make sure my memory was correct, they are all sadly irrelevant to what is facing us today. They're on compensation, shadow banking, resolution recovery. I mean, you can sort of draw a line to them, but none of them hit directly at the core issues that we are facing right now. So I'm afraid to say, on that mark of an outcome assessment, it's not a terribly good one. Second, on the notion of international consistency and sort of coordination. Here, I would say the FSB actually made a very, very good start. Under Mario Draghi's leadership, a lot of different constituencies were corralled together, and there was a sense of shared purpose that led to, and this is where it gets confusing about who does what, but anyway, the Basel Committee produced Basel III, which I don't think would have been produced had you not had the FSB providing the force and leadership and umbrella underneath it. So, sort of very good mark for that. Where, however, I am more critical is I think since that sort of high point, we've been busily paddling backwards, and that there has been an increasing fragmentation with most countries saying, well, once we've done that, now we want to either not implement it or implement it in our own variant, and add lots of separate bells and whistles. The UK is, you know, particularly guilty of this with its own sorts of proposals about ring fencing and all sorts of things, and its own version of the liquidity regulations. But it's equally true of the US. And so that sense of common purpose and consistency is rapidly diminishing. And there are real costs of that for the global system. There are costs of complexity, the cost of regulatory arbitrage. We are getting into a very, very confusing situation. The law of unintended consequences is going to be hitting us pretty, and is hitting us pretty hard. And just to give you one small example of this, one of the core proposals of the new liquidity regulations, and there absolutely needed to be better liquidity regulations, is that all banks needed to hold much more sovereign debt. That is now not looking quite as compelling an argument as it might have done when those rules were drafted. So I think there's some very sensible proposals around fine-tuning the governance of the FSB. I think it's important to recognize how important it is. I think we need to be careful, though, that we don't turn it into something that is so rigid and bureaucratic that it doesn't add any value. These are very complex, difficult issues. You need real discussion around them and in-depth dialogue. You can't just sort of do it through exchange of prepared statements. I am on an outcomes basis. I would hesitate to give too high an assessment grade to the FSB at this stage.
Thank you, Peter. And with your following your candid assessment, I will now turn to Mary.
Thank you. And thank you for the chance to read what is an excellent issues paper and an interesting commission report. There's really just two things that I want to say this morning. The first is about the substance of why we should worry about the impact of the FSB on developing countries. And the second is about the governance model and where that discussion goes. Because I think on the second, the Commission's panel has rather heroically struggled with two very different models. And so I just want to pull that tension out and put it in front of us. But let's start with the why developing countries could matter. Because I can imagine if the FSB staff were here, they would feel a little bit like firefighters who are fighting a huge blaze in their own home, being held to account about the environmental consequences of the way they were fighting the fire, or even about the standard of democracy in the local fire station. And they would look at us perplexed and say, you've got to be kidding. You know, you want us to be thinking about accountability mechanisms and about inclusive mechanisms when we've got a crisis on our hands and we have to be firefighting. So let's start with that proposition. I mean, I think there's two responses that I would have to that proposition. One is that even in terms of their own mandate on financial stability, it will be crucial that one part of the standard setting they're engaged in is taken up and implemented in developing countries. Otherwise, you simply push the crisis, you just push the weaknesses and vulnerabilities out to the periphery. So it's crucial to their own mandate on financial stability. But the other issue is that's fine. The firefighters' view is one view, but that doesn't mean that the rest of us shouldn't be thinking about, be concerned about, and be feeding into the FSB what the likely consequences of their activities and the wider activities of what we might call the Basel world, including, of course, the Basel Committee, are. And so just very briefly on that, to me, there are at least five reasons why five ways in which the Basel standards and the Basel world's current deliberations will affect developing countries. And it's these kinds of issues that we should be focused on and feeding in. The first is obviously the trade finance one, where over the last year we've seen a huge debate because it was clear that the Basel world hadn't even thought about the implications on trade finance. They're now trying to find a new pathway to think about that. That's a positive outcome. Hopefully it will lead to a positive result. The second is that the new Basel standards and other standards the FSB are working on could seriously overstretch national capacity. That even the Basel standards themselves require capacity, discretion, and judgment. We are still in a world where global financial regulation is being formulated so as to impact as less costly as possible on financial services sector actors. We're not in a world where regulatory standards are being made to make them as cheap, effective, and enforceable for regulators as they might be. And for that reason, for developing countries, I think there's a particular set of issues around capacity and to what degree they should be making the choice to put a lot of their own scarce resources into that capacity. A third is about the home host issues, very complex issues about which model of regulation, subsidiaries, branches, is best for any one developing country. The one overriding lesson from those issues is that it is crucial for developing country regulators to have much better quality of information from home regulators about banks operating in their jurisdiction. And we've seen remarkably little progress towards the arrangements for making that kind of information sharing possible. A fourth reason is, of course, the extent to which the tighter global and capital and liquidity standards might affect the scope for developing countries to use those standards in the immediate term, given that there's a long-term transition period for the centre's financial services sector. Will that impact the way developing countries can use those standards in a counter-cyclical way? I think, well, I'll stop there on the reasons why we should be concerned about the consequences for developing countries of the FSB and the wider Basel world process, because I do want to move to the issue of governance. Now, it's tempting, as we see half the commission? I don't know, but just reading the report, it felt to me like perhaps half the commission was saying, we need a treaty-based international organization, a bit like the IMF, to set the global standards, because then We will have rights of representation, of consultation, we'll have rights to information, and there might even be some enforcement. So that has a kind of intuitive appeal. And perhaps the reason why some of your commission panel found that intuitively appealing is because there is a really stark contrast in the world, for example, of trade, where globalization has been undertaken alongside a more and more robust global regulatory system, which states have formulated. So we have the Marrakesh Agreement, we have the WTO, we have centralized adjudication. The globalization of finance has been hugely more rapid, hugely deeper, and there has been absolutely no accompanying centralization of global regulation. Instead, we've seen governments consistently keep delegating to private standard-setting organizations. And that, I think, is why there is now an impulse to say, we need now to make that system more coherent. So what we've seen is governments form a kind of super network in the G20 and a sub-network in the FSB. Not a treaty organization, but an organization created by a press release, which could actually probably be disbanded by a press release. But let's stop before we immediately conclude, therefore, what we now need is a treaty-based organization. Let me just throw one spanner in that little machine. And that's that what we are seeing in the Financial Stability Board is a gritty, bottom-up process of standard setting, where national regulators who really do understand the possibilities and limits of regulation in their own countries get together and really try to work out how to piece their national regulatory systems together. It's a very bottom-up process. Contrast that to the IMF process, which is very top-down, which has been accused for about 20 years of being too top-down, one-size-fits-all, impositional. And think about which is it that you want? Which kind of system is it that you want? The real problem with the FSB process, I don't think, is the bottom-up nature of the process. The problem is the narrowness of it. It's the fact that it is essentially just the G10 countries who are wrangling among each other. And when we look at what's happened since the 2008 crisis, there's been a real attempt to create more cooperation in supervision and regulation. We've seen an explosion that Peter mentioned of alphabet soup, of more and more bodies. But as Adair Turner has commented, 70% of the membership of all these dozens of committees is the same, and 70% of the agenda is the same. So you have the same small group of regulators from a small group of countries flying around to meetings with each other. And the logic of that is simply because each time you create a new committee, the existing actors say, you must include us on that committee. And so you get this kind of replication. So clearly there is some tidying up needed. Well, it's not actually just about tidying up. This isn't about housekeeping. This is about taking my first point seriously about what the impact on developing countries might be, and then thinking about how we expand the narrowness of that process. Now, I don't have a magic solution I'm going to put in front of you, but all I would say is there is something in the bottom-up process of the FSB which looks a bit like what critics of the Fund and Bank have often asked for. But at the same time, it's a process that doesn't have any way at the moment of making sure that it's taking into account the very serious impacts on developing countries. So to that end, I think this commission is a terrific start in opening up the questions that need debating, and I would congratulate the panel for the effort.
Thank you very much, Nairi. If I may, I'd like just to follow up on one of the points that some of the presenters today have raised, and that is the FSB is a very unique organization because it really clusters together official agencies like finance ministries, central banks, regulators, other international regulatory bodies with standard-setting bodies. Even more so, the FSB was given the mandate to overview the work of the standard-setting bodies themselves. And yet, how can the FSB really be able to deliver on this mandate in the absence of legal enforcement powers? On the one hand, the SSBs are members of the FSB. On the other, the FSB is supposed to overview them. And yet, the FSB is not even a formal organization. Its charter does not even constitute, does not even allow for any obligations on the on the members themselves. So how can it be deliver its own mandate in, through formal enforcement, through peer pressure, just through learning? And I would invite, you know, some perhaps some more elaboration on this point from the presenters.
Well, I guess, is that me?
Yes.
Okay.
We can start from you, yes.
Okay. Thanks. Yeah, I was listening very closely to the other commentators, and it is a tension, Domenico, between how do you have a requirement to implement with not everybody in the room, and the obligation within the FSB is that we might agree by consensus in the plenary on a set of regulations, and then everybody's supposed to go home and implement it individually, which it just doesn't happen, or it happens in some places and not in the right places. And so there is that tension, and I would like to say that the panel with its recommendations recognizes the evolutionary nature of the FSB. It is unique. It's positive that it's the actual worker bees, the actual regulators who are in the room discussing face-to-face. That's great, as opposed to turning it into another international organization where the finance ministry takes over. The foreign ministry. We do not need another foreign ministry international organization. And it's good for the regulators to come together and be systematized. That doesn't negate the impact on the non-members. And I'm going to harp on this. This is my shtick. And in regard to Neri's argument or vivid image of the firefighters protecting their own home, well, as they're protecting their own home and trying to put out that fire, they're throwing sparks everywhere. And that causes other people's homes to go up in flame, and they don't have the resources of the fire department. So I sympathize. I live in the house that's on fire. Yes, but we're going to have to pull together on this. It has to be a common effort. With regard to the IMF being top-down and this being bottom-up, let me just refer to one additional recommendation we have, and that is that when these regional bodies get going that are being set up by the FSB, with the FSB naming the members and naming the co-chairs, well, that doesn't smell right. It doesn't pass the smell test. The region has to determine which countries they want if they're going to play by this game. And not only the current member, as in the case of Africa, that South Africa would go and participate in the plenaries and represent the interests of the entire continent of Africa, but why not the co-chair that the region selects? So we have recommended that the regionally selected co-chair also be a participant in the plenaries. Secondly, and that's an interim step for your two models, Neri, and another interim step is let's use the expertise that exists beyond the G20. And my reference point here is a paper by Victor Morindi that will be posted on the FSB Watch website, which discusses exactly the issue of the impact of Basel III on Africa, the gaps in the regulation, the both what's needed and what isn't there. And Victor is one of many experts in the developing world who have much to contribute on the regulatory front, who can contribute to the issue of the fires being started by, whether deliberate or accidental, certainly never deliberate, but it's a reality, the accidental sparks springing from my house being on fire. So, and I really love hearing the feedback, so thank you, Peter and Neri, for your comments. We panelists are just loving your feedback. Thank you.
Actually, talking about the panelists, I just saw earlier on Harold James joining the audience. I want to acknowledge his presence. He was a very engaged panelist, and just want to thank him for his feedback throughout the deliberations of the high-level panel. Peter, would...
Well, first, on the point of the sort of legal status of the Financial Stability Board and its ability to enforce things, I think we've got to be realistic about the art of the possible. If that had been a precondition for the creation of the Financial Stability Board, there wouldn't be a Financial Stability Board. It only got made because it didn't have any power. And I think it is better that it exists with only limited influence over its members than it didn't exist at all. I would like it to have a bit more teeth. I think its peer reviews are feeble. They're far too polite. But I don't think where the world is and the big powers are not yet ready to cede the power that would be involved by a treaty-based organization around that. And maybe that's where we're going to go. And as you say, it's an evolutionary model, but we're not there yet. I do think the issue of the non-members is a very real issue, and certainly as somebody who runs a bank which is mainly focused on the developing world, we have been very vocal in our interactions with the Basel Committee, IOSCO, FSB, and everybody, about issues like trade finance and the unintended consequences and the complete inapplicability. I mean, there are bits of Basel III that rely on synthetic CDS spreads of institutions, which may sound very plausible when you're talking about London and New York, but completely irrelevant for large chunks of the world. And it becomes very difficult to know how to implement some of the recommendations. And they have weird unintended consequences. The trade-off, however, as always with these things, and it's not unique to this realm, is between inclusiveness and effectiveness. Already the FSB is a significant expansion of the FSF, and to those who were prior members, they would claim in private that there has been a decline in the efficacy of it. And indeed, there is already an inner cabal within the FSB of the old members of the FSF. The risk of more expansion, and I completely accept the arguments of inclusiveness and the need to understand the impact of the developing world. But I also think we need to be very mindful of what we will end up with. If you significantly formally expand the FSB, what you will undoubtedly get is a more powerful inner cabal working informally within it. And I think to not acknowledge that is sort of kidding oneself. So somehow or other, we need to square the circle of acknowledging where power lies. Hi, Sven. Where power lies, the need to have a relatively small group of people to have real dialogue and efficiency, but also find a way to represent and understand the views and needs of the developing world.
Okay, so I just want to welcome Svein Andersson, the Secretary General of the Financial Stability Board. We're especially delighted that you could make it, given all what's going on. So just to give you a little bit of breath coming out from, another meeting as you do, I would pass, I would ask Mary and Ezra if they have remarks, my earlier question to quickly follow up, and then we'll give the floor to Svein. He may, comment on the high-level panel's report and then make remarks related to the current and future challenges of the FSB. Mary?
I guess the only remark I would make is that process is not going to... Just thinking about the FSB processes won't solve all problems. If you go on the FSB website now, you'll find that to their great credit, they've posted their documentation. They've posted, for example, their proposal on resolution. They've posted all the commentaries through their had an open consultation process. They've posted all the different responses to their proposal. When you go down the list of the responses, you of course find every industry association interested in financial services, because they're obviously the people that have a close interest in following these issues. And it just highlights to me that there are two preconditions for making, the goal is surely not to get more people into the room for the hell of it. The goal is surely not to have some abstract vision of what democracy looks like and to try to apply that to it, to the FSB. That's surely not the goal. The goal is to ensure that accurate, timely inputs are made from different stakeholders across the world, including developing countries. And the two preconditions for that are, A, that they have timely information, and B, that they have the capacity and resources to respond in a timely way to that information. And that the third, of course, is that the institution permits them to respond. We have an institution that is permitting and encouraging them to respond. But what we don't have is the capacity. So where might we look for that capacity beyond the industry associations who, you know, will, of course, understandably be pushing their own interests? Where can we look? Can we look to the academic community, of which I'm a paid-up member? Perhaps. But that's going to take some efforts to think about. It's also going to take some ethical standards on the side of the academic community, as the pre-crisis economic research showed, that the academic community we need to be careful of. We need to always know who's funded their research. And there has to be an ethics rule in the academic community about being upfront about that, so that the interest base of any research is taken into account. But what other ways are there? And I think that's the challenge for making this process work. What do you need? I think in the United States, for example, when we think about environmental regulation, there is actually a levying of the private sector to fund an independent set of watchdog organizations. Is it that kind of thing that the global financial regulatory process needs? So I would just, rather than saying we solve this simply by saying the FSB should be more participatory, it should be more inclusive and more transparent, let's go one step deeper and say, what is the capacity that's needed to ensure that actors outside of the financial services sector itself have timely access to information and good capacity to digest it and make timely, precise inputs into the process?
Thank you, Mary. Ezra?
Yes, I would agree with Professor Woods that our problem as developing countries has not been enforcement. We've suffered too much enforcement. The IMF has been able to enforce standards only because they had resources that we needed, and so we had to accept the various standards that they came with. So I think that the issue of consultation, of our having a sense of belonging, of being part of the world system, is perhaps a more important problem for us now. I think the enforcement, for us, from our point of view, is not a major issue, but whether we are consulted or not.
Thank you very much, Ezra, for raising this important point about broad-based consultations. I would now give the floor to Svein. So I would suggest perhaps you use 5, 7, 8 minutes at most, and then we can open up a Q&A session with the audience.
Thank you. Does it work, this? I pulled it off.
Yeah. It does. I think it does.
Well, thank you very much for having invited me, and thank you very much for the work that you have done and that McGeer's group did as well. Been very helpful to us in the FSB as we contemplate changes to the way the FSB is set up and how it works. I think many of the issues about capacity, resources, institutional underpinnings of the FSB are arising because the ambit of work of the FSB has expanded quite dramatically. It was set up in the form of a call for through a press release of the G20 leaders, and that's really all that it is. It has a very, very small secretariat. It has very capable individuals sitting within it, but it is a structure that has many, many merits to it, but it has underpinnings which are not quite commensurate with the role that it plays. And there are no easy answers to this. I think that there are questions of resources, and I think those are in the process of being addressed. The FSB Secretariat remains still very, very small. It's about 20 people now, but that is 3.5 times as many as it was about 3 years ago. There are questions about where these resources should be coming from over time as the FSB expands. The central banks have so far provided most of these resources. As this expands, it's not clear that that will be the case. If another issue for us is staffing, all staffing of the FSB are seconded to this body, stay for generally very short periods of time, and then move on. That has many, many positive side effects, but it also means a tremendous amount of turnover and lack of capacity to build institutional memory in this body. So it comes to what are the mechanisms that enable the FSB to address some of these challenges. And in that context, whether or not it should adopt more formal legal underpinnings has arisen. I think that that would have merits because it would enable the FSB to hire staff in its own capacity. It would crystallize and force a resolution to the issue of funding over time. And it will enable the FSB to develop more articulated transparency and accountability structures than it now has. There are advantages to the informality of the FSB. I think the flexibility and speed that gives it is something that authorities and the global community would not want to give up. But as the role of the FSB becomes more important, clearly there is a need for this body to be seen to have the mechanisms of transparency, explicability, accountability, to demonstrate this accountability that people would like to see it have. So we are discussing these issues, and we will have some thoughts coming out of the FSB for the G20 summit in Cannes, and I think separately there will be thoughts on these issues coming out of a process coming into the Cannes summit at the leaders' level. If I could respond a little bit to some of the issues that you raised in your recommendations, I think that in no particular order, the issues of implementation monitoring enforcement. The FSB cannot be an enforcement body, and if it were to have legal underpinnings, I think we need to think of that in an organizational support mechanism rather than it having enforcement capacity. Of course, I don't think countries would ever cede that to an international body. But there are many things that we can do to foster implementation and coherence in implementation. And it is important that we do so because we can agree good policies. Not everybody will agree that the policies are good. Peter would have different views than I. But if we don't get them implemented consistently, there will be delusion along the way, and over time they will not achieve their objectives. And as Nagir has pointed out, a process of a complaints mechanism, in effect harnessing the interest in of the marketplace in having a level playing field in the rules that apply to participants. They keep looking at each other and what applies to themselves in different kinds of jurisdictions, and there might be merits to us in harnessing their interest in a level playing field by having them come to us and tell us that this country over there has cheated on the implementation of agreed policies. We are putting in place a quite a detailed process for implementation monitoring, but it will not have the quality of enforcement. It will probably not have consequences for FSB members if they do not implement. You mentioned that the FSB and the IMF should work together on capital flows issues. I'm not so sure that I would advocate FSB involvement in cross-border capital flows issues, at least as far as that pertains to macro issues. There are, of course, prudential issues having to do with the management of FX risks and mismatch risks and so on, where the FSB and the prudential committees have roles. On the relationship to the standard-setting bodies, this is kind of complicated. Overwhelmingly positive and good. The FSB has a role to coordinate the work of the standard-setting bodies, of which, as you know, there are quite a number. And I think one of the reasons why we have the FSB is that for those that have political responsibility in our countries, when something goes wrong and they have to stand up and say, to tell the press who's responsible for addressing this and this and that sort of problem, you are not going to find any leader in the world who can say it's the CPSS, it's IOSCO, CGFS, ISB, BCBS, and so on, and keep straight what these different bodies are doing. And so there is a need to have coordination and a kind of accountability mechanism for standard-setting bodies. But we all benefit enormously from independent standard-setting. And the fact is, it is an important means for the international community of solving coordination problems. Those problems don't typically get solved easily at the political level. And at the political level, an agreement struck at one time may not stick when circumstances change. So we need independent standard-setting bodies, but there needs to be the possibility of interaction between the political process and imperatives and the standard-setting process, and I think the FSB does that relatively well. How overt should that coordination role be? It's a continuous tension, which probably is productive, but if it is enshrined in statute, as it were, it may become, well, let's put it this way, you wouldn't get the standard setting bodies to sign on to it. it's a political issue as much as it is an issue that can be solved within the FSB itself. You suggested that we should have a more structured process for the selection of the FSB chair and an independent evaluation for better accountability and so on. All of these are very good ideas, and I think illustrative of the fact that, as I said at the beginning, the FSB is in between being an informal body and needing to become something other than just an informal cooperating mechanism. At the moment, we are in the process of identifying a successor to the current chair, and that is not, as you know, going to be a structured, open nominations process with hearings and all of that. It will be a process in which there is nominations brought forward to the chair, and the chair consults the members on consensus on a successor. And of course, were the organization to be a structured institutional setup, these are arrangements that would need to change. I would like to just end by pointing out that first of all, the FSB has some 24 member countries and large numbers of other bodies as members. We are in the process of setting up a regional consultative structure, which will mean that about 70 other countries will become part of this mechanism, with chairs of these regional bodies becoming parts of the FSB. So we hope that that will enable others to input into this process in a way that may not have been as good up till the present. We are sometimes criticized for not having enough consultation with NGOs, with industry bodies, and so on. I think that the principal way in which we think of this working is that all the people that sit in the FSB are nationals, and every one of them must consult quite a bit domestically and do consult their industry, their various NGOs, their legislatures, and so on. And what they come together to do in the FSB is to sift through all this, their own views, and attempt to agree on what they should be trying to do. And that process of getting agreement is not one that is always very easy. And the time that you have available to bring these decision makers together is not a very large amount of time. And spending that time with organizations that many of them ought to have consulted previously, at least in this phase in which it has been important to get reform objectives agreed, has not been the highest priority. It is a bit of an issue that the numbers, just like the FSB itself, the numbers of players and bodies involved is very numerous. We can meet with the IIF, but meeting with the IIF is not sufficient, of course. There is, on the industry side, any number of additional bodies. And we have to find ways of meeting with organizations that represent society at large. So we know that this is a work site for us. We are not an institution in which the people that sit in the secretariat write the policies. It's the members that agree the policies. We help them write the pen. So it doesn't help to come and talk to us. You have to have that consultation with members. But the time they have to agree these policies is, as I said, relatively limited. Well, I'm very happy to take questions. I'm sure I have not covered everything that you wanted me to. But
thank you very much, Svein, for your remarks. I think we will open up to the audience for questions. I would suggest that we're going to group, questions in sets of three or four, and then we'll give it a chance to the panelists to respond. So, Colin Bradford, can you please identify yourself?
Thank you very much, Domenico. I'm Colin Bradford from the Brookings Institution and CG in Canada, that has also been very involved in this, Erica Liner being a major contributor to the literature on the FSB. But I speak to you more in my role as a board member of the New Rules for Global Finance group, which is sponsoring this project. And I'd like to just bring up for what is, I think, obvious, an underlying dynamic of all this, which is really central and I think needs to be more the pivot of how all this goes forward, and that is, of course, the national political resistance that there is to really undertaking serious national, much less global, reform and institutional development that can, in fact, prevent future financial crises like the one we have. I would submit to you that it's a reasonable hypothesis to say that today we're not significantly better off in terms of national structures for supervision, oversight, and regulation of financial markets and institutions than we were 3 years ago. And that is not the fault of the FSB. It's not the fault of the fact that there aren't enough countries in it. It's a question of responsiveness to political pressures. So the question, I think, that this dynamic is what all these issues need to be pivoted around. Because in a certain sense, you have to address that resistance in order to get any movement forward on this at the national and global level. So that's what I would basically say. And I would go with where Neri was headed, I think, and which came to me in a new rules board meeting we had earlier this week, which is, let's not underestimate the power that an independent monitoring body made up of researchers and advocates, much as the new rules group itself functions, to hold the feet to the fire of national politicians and regulators, or would-be regulators, and make things happen rather than let things slip. Thank you.
Thank you. Colin?
I'm a member of Per Kurovsky, also a member of New Rules for Global Finance, which is a very wide alliance, let's say, of interests. The Basel Committee was obviously not set up to bring instability to the system. The purpose was a search for stability. Unfortunately, in that search, they introduced so much rigidity that the system became fragile and not flexible enough, and now we have this crisis. What is the purpose of Financial Stability Board? Stability is not enough for us development countries. We want flexibility. We want to be grow. What is the purpose? Why is it not called, for instance, the Financial Functionability Board, something that shows what we are looking for? Stability, we'll have that in the graveyard. Meanwhile, we need to grow. Thank you.
We had a question on the back, and then I met you, Martin.
Rahul Prabhakar, University of Oxford. My question is directed towards Mr. Sands, who mentioned that the FSB is powerless because the big powers refuse to cede power to it. My question is directed towards saying that if it were the private sector that were pushing for more formalized mechanisms at the FSB, I think they're the particular audience that should be addressed. And going back to Nari's point on the complaint mechanism. If level playing field issues between American and European and Asian banks truly are of that great a concern, wouldn't the FSB offer the sort of forum and the mechanisms available to lodge complaints? And in that way, transparency and accountability and governance will be the sort of spillover effects of private sector actors pursuing their own interests aligned with overall social benefit.
Thank you. We have two more questions. Matthew Martin and Tony Elson.
Thank you. Matthew Martin, Development Finance International. We help low-income countries get their voice across about these international financial issues, and indeed yesterday produced the communique by 25 low-income countries that Joe Marie referred to, which made reference to the FSB. I was going to ask the question in relation to the panel's recommendations about why you thought it was necessary to get to the status of being a treaty-based body before you could really have proper representation of low-income countries. But because, notably, the G20 has low-income countries on it, decided to bring in low-income countries without any treaty-based decisions. But then I heard Sline say at the end, one of the recommendations of the committee had been that the co-chairs of these regional groups should be full members of the FSB, and I think I heard Svein saying that that was going to be the case. But I wanted to ask, first of all, is that definitely going to be the case? But secondly, a supplementary question, because talking a lot to members of the FSB at the moment, they often give the implication that the plenary of the FSB is a bit of a overall body which kind of ex post approves things, may look at terms of reference for things, but doesn't get down to the nitty-gritty. And to come back to Nairi's analogy of top-down and bottom-up, I think a lot of low-income countries see the FSB at the moment a bit as G20 top-down tells the FSB what to do. The members of the FSB regulators sit in the subsidiary bodies and in the committees and working groups and do the bottom-up stuff. And then top-down along comes somebody from the international level and tells them that they must implement what those that little group of regulators implemented. So I'm concerned, and indeed what the minister said yesterday was we don't just want to be in the plenary, we want to be in those standard-setting bodies and we want to be in those working groups and committees, because otherwise we think we'll be coming along to be consulted ex post about things that have already been decided. So is that going to happen too?
Thank you, Martin. Tony Elson over there.
Thank you. Tony Elson, Johns Hopkins SAIS. I wanted to ask members of the panel if the issue of division of labor among the FSB, the BIS, and the IMF in the oversight of global systemic stability was addressed. It seems to me there should be a clearer division of labor among these three institutions. As you know, in November 2008, there was a letter of cooperation signed between the IMF managing director and the FSB chairman, but it seems to me that was superseded by the charter for the FSB. So I wonder if this issue was addressed by the panel.
Thank you. So I would start from Svein, and I would say that each of you has no more than 3 minutes to pick up on the questions raised by the audience.
Well, implementation monitoring, Colin. I think that the world needs implementation monitoring, and by those that have strong incentives to do so, but one shouldn't underestimate the work involved and the difficulty of doing this. There's no simple way. And if you want to do it really to a point where you know that you've gotten to the level of issues that are going to matter in shaping the conditions that a market faces, institutions face, it is phenomenally labor-intensive. And the fund and the bank does this in numbers with huge resource needs and well, but cannot do it sufficiently. Nonetheless, naming and shaming authorities that sit around the table and agree rules and then do not implement them themselves, I think is entirely reasonable thing to do. Should we not become the Financial Functionality Board? I think that I don't think there is a contradiction between financial stability and financial functionality. Indeed, that would be really, really bad. We cannot have functionality in the financial system in a reliable way without some sort of rules of the game. And whether we get or authorities get the rules of the game right is a legitimate issue for debate. And I think there are a few things in which there has been invested as much thinking in, frankly. There has been a lot of thinking invested in this by market participants, academics, authorities for years and years and years. And might not be perfect. I think we've changed many things in the right sort of way. And we will need to adjust as we learn to do it better. And everybody should be invited to be part of that endeavor. Sorry, I've spoken too long. I think on the issues that Matthew raised that the FSB is, you know, we have a plenary. The plenary of the FSB has 70 persons sitting in it. You cannot debate many fine points of regulation in a group of 70 people unless they meet for a week. And with the level of people that sit in the FSB, that's never going to happen. So it needs to have other mechanisms of much smaller groups drawn from within the membership that that settle many of these issues. And that is the case. These groups must not be confined to the membership of the FSB. They can have outside members. Practice of that happening is likely to change once this regional consultative mechanism is set up, and if the members of the regional consultative groups show the level of interest that is needed, because it does take investment to be part of these bodies and contribute to them being productive. I think I'll stop there.
Thank you, Svein. Jean-Marie?
Okay, thank you. I want to thank Svein for being here. It's really a refreshing openness on the part of the staff. We know you're pressed. I wanted to note one element of surprise, thinking that those busy nationals who are seconded to your organization, one, that they're known, that people know to talk to them, and that, I mean, I need to figure out who's on staff to go talk to them and to do my lobbying. What can I say? Also, hoping that both co-chairs of the regional entities are going to be present in the plenaries. Delighted that the smaller working groups now are open to non-members. We hope you recruit and are advertising enough to get low-income countries and developing countries beyond the members to participate. That would really be, as we say, getting into the engine room where, you know, you're helping to repair the machinery, if not design new machinery. And then I just want to again thank all of you for being here and to invite you to check out the fsbwatch.org. FSBWatch is one word. There are no periods or commas in between. fsbwatch.org website that will go live today. And to thank Jamie Baker in back, who's taking pictures, recording, set up the website, does the dishes, and designs the strategic plan. So thank you.
Thanks, Jamari. Peter, do you want to react?
I'll pick up specifically on the question of the role of the private sector. There's a very wide range of views in the private sector, so I can't pretend to talk for the private sector as a whole. But what I would say is that there are a significant number of CEOs of major institutions around the world who I think would be, like me, agreeing that the creation of the FSB was a very good thing, and that as an effort, however imperfect in its sort of formal design, to get some consistency and coherence to what a lot of the standard-setting bodies were doing, and to bring together at least some of the countries in dialogue about what needed to be done, I think it's been a very positive thing. So I think the private sector has a very strong interest in seeing it succeed in that role. I think similarly, particularly those of us who are active in the developing parts of the world, making sure that the interests and views of the developing world are represented in those debates is important. Implementation monitoring is something that, in a sense, we can help with because we see it. In a very, very tangible, concrete way, all the differences and distinctions and the reality beyond the fine words of what actually happens in terms of the implementation of regulation. And I think that is somewhere where there's probably more work to be done between the private sector and the FSB as to sort of how we can practically assist with what, as Sven said, is a very laborious task, because it's only interesting at a granular level of detail. Because at a high level, everybody agrees that they're doing exactly the same thing. It just doesn't turn out like that when you look at it at the nitty-gritty. I think this point about division of labor is an important point, which is that I think, as I say, as a CEO of a bank actively involved in regulatory debates, I find it completely bewildering as to what the remit is of the different various bodies and things involved in all of this. I don't think it'll ever be completely simple. The world's too complicated for that. But there's probably useful work to be done to get some clarity on the map of who does what. That's all I was going to say.
Thanks. Nairi and then Ezra.
So I'd like also to pick up on this issue of the division of labor and FSB, IMFBIS, to really underscore the role that the standard-setting bodies are playing. Let's not miss them out of the equation because they're more difficult to study. My Oxford colleague and co-author, Walter Matley, together with Tim Booth, have recently completed and published the only global survey of the members of the private standard-setting organizations. And their study is pretty devastating. Those private standard-setting organizations are failing. They're failing a lot of their members in their members' views. And one part of those failings is about the governance of those standard-setting bodies. So I think it is very important that those standard-setting bodies are actually looked at. Now, when Svein said that what the FSB has been asked to do is coordinate the standard-setting bodies, my first thought was a memory of about 5 years ago when the head of a large multinational corporation, listening to a discussion on global governance, said, which was all about coordination, said, "The word coordination makes me very worried." He said, "When I hear people talking about coordination, it means that they are neither managing nor delegating." In other words, coordination is just a way of avoiding responsibility. And I think that's true, and that is exactly what it means in this context. And to simply ask the FSB with no formal powers to coordinate a group of standard-setting bodies without addressing the standard-setting bodies is not going to get us very far. Have I got time to make one other point, or should I stop? I'm happy to stop. Okay, because the other point I just wanted to raise was really to come back to Colin Bradford's point about how you get robust regulation, which is led by countries who are so dependent on large financial services sectors, when we know that the financial services sector has practically infinitely more resources, expertise, lobbying power, and so forth, than the regulators. And to me, there are two very simple models. And there are only two simple models that can work in that context. So one is the model where you say that the regulation has to be first and foremost designed so as to make the job of the regulators the simplest, the easiest, and the least resource heavy. And that kind of regulation is very simple, it's very crude, and it applies very hard costs on the industry being regulated. But at least you get the outcome of regulation that's effective. The alternative model, and this is the model that I've put in other fora that Svein was mentioning, is to say, okay, where is the information and the expertise? It's in the private sector. So how do we design regulation so as to ensure that the private sector itself has a proprietary stake in enforcing it? How do we design responsibilities and rights so that different private sector companies actually start monitoring whether governments across the world are complying and are implementing, and so that they have an interest in actually bringing to the attention of their own government where compliance is failing? It's a kind of, I've started calling it regulatory judo, because I think that that's the other model. But either way, to me, those are the only two models that can actually work, and that's what the experience of the last decade shows us.
Thank you, Nairi. Ezra?
Yeah, I just want to say that I hope that our recommendation for a bottom-up approach in forming the regional consultative organizations will be looked at. And that the point about a co-chair, not only having a co-chair, but having a secretariat at the regional level that is able to do some capacity building, that is able to build up the technical capacity of our countries to understand and follow what is going on in FSB and SSBs. Thank you.
Thank you, Ezra. So let me wrap up. Of course, I want to thank you first and foremost, the presenters today, for their excellent job, and thank you for coming. Many of you are coming from Europe or from Africa, so again, thanks so much for joining us. I want again to thank the members of the high-level panels for their wonderful job and engagement throughout this project. Let me clarify that the initiative of the high-level panel on the FSB is completely independent of the FSB itself, and so does its funding. As I said at the outset, the recommendations from the high-level panel will be available, the printed versions, from the reception desk, and of course, by now, they should have already been posted on the Brookings website. I also want to thank Maolin Shen and Stephen Magnusson for their wonderful work in setting up this event and for taking care of the communication-related aspects of the high-level panel, together with Jamie Baker, who's right there, managing the video camera. So, again, thank you very much. Thanks, Svein. So I hope to see you at possibly a follow-up event to this one this morning. Thank you. Good.